Committee on Natural Resources for the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for the Oregon Legislature, May 3rd, 2017. And today we have a public hearing on House Bill 5010, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and so I will open up that public hearing. And I believe we have two folks scheduled to come and speak with us about this. Lots of pictures.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the department here to talk about their facilities. You requested that they come back. I would also note that saved under the March 27th meeting date, there's a pretty lengthy response and to questions about the ODF&W biologists and what they do.
Thank you. Mr. Melcher.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We're here today to talk with you about deferred maintenance. We did prepare quite a lengthy slide deck, as you'll see, but we do not plan to go through the entire deck. We have selected out a subset of those, and then happy to discuss any other slides that you may want to bring forward. But I do have with me today my chief engineer, Ryan McCormick, who will be making the bulk of the presentation, but I wanted to offer at least some introductory comments. So as you all know, the department owns approximately a little over 70 facilities statewide that are that house staff. These facilities, many of these facilities are in excess of 100 years old. So we have structures that are over 100 years old in our on our inventory list, if you will. And we've had a long-standing, certainly for my entire career, perhaps longer-standing deferred maintenance issue with these facilities that we've recognized and have needed to address over time.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, yes.
Kurt, what's several? How many is several?
In terms of the
what's the number of?
We could tabulate the precise number, but I think it's at least a half dozen. The facilities are over 100 years
six
old.
Six or more, six to ten. Or
yeah, something like that.
Okay, very good.
Absolutely. And then there's multiple structures. So just for instance, and we'll get into. Actually, I won't say that now. We'll get into the details. But some of these facilities have multiple structures that have a wide range in ages. Some of the structures may be in excess of 100 years old, and others that are much more contemporary than that. So we do and have recognized the longstanding deferred maintenance need at our facilities. In 2005, we commissioned a private engineering firm, the DLR Group, to perform a complete and comprehensive facility assessment of the department-owned facilities. And the estimated deferred maintenance needs at those facilities was approximately $94 million. I would point out that some of those deferred maintenance items we would categorize in the nice-to-have category as opposed to the absolutely need-to-have, things like paving of gravel parking areas. Nonetheless, a sizable deferred maintenance backlog. And then just to update you on something that's going on right now, as part of the, of course, as part of the Secretary of State's audit, it was pointed out this deferred maintenance need at the department, and the Department of Administrative Services has a contractor that's doing an update on some of our larger facilities that are larger, at least in terms of square footage or in terms of value of the structure. That is currently underway and not yet complete. So we wanted to talk a little bit about our maintenance efforts and the path moving forward, and just recognizing that we have this large deferred maintenance backlog, that doesn't mean that we have not been addressing deferred maintenance needs over time, but certainly we have more projects than we have the resources to complete. So our purpose, of course, is to maintain the services of these facilities and the benefits provided to our constituents and citizens of Oregon. Goes without saying, regular investment in maintenance avoids much more costly long-term repairs or replacements. And many of our deferred maintenance actions, and we're going to talk a little bit about them, are also, they have dual benefits. So, for instance, at some of our hatcheries where we have needs for instance, for new water control structures, part of the package also includes enhancements to the to benefits to the watershed. For instance, it includes providing fish passage at many of those structures. Over the last several years, we've completed a number of deferred maintenance projects or have some underway that we just wanted to mention. I won't go through each of them in any detail, but as you can see, we have been using resources as are available to address deferred maintenance. And then for the first time in many, many biennia, the governor's recommended budget includes a general obligation bonding request of $10 million for conducting deferred maintenance at agency hatchery structures or hatchery facilities. And lastly, just wanted to mention, as Representative Helm can attest to, in all of the discussions with the House Bill 2402 Alternative Funding Task Force, addressing deferred maintenance through that alternative funding package was one of their objectives as well. So with that, I'm going to hand this off to Ryan, Mr. McCormick, and then I will perhaps interject a few thoughts and comments over the course of his presentation.
All right, thank you. So, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Committee. For the record, my name is Ryan McCormick. I'm the Chief Engineer for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Today, I'm going to go over a summary of a deferred maintenance project list for our different facilities. I've prepared it in three different parts. The first part will be hatcheries. Second part will be offices and other facilities, and then the third part will be our wildlife areas. So in this slide that you see before you, this is a kind of a representation of what we work with when we do some deferred maintenance at our facilities. So this particular hatchery had a second story office that they were doing some work on it, and they discovered that there were some issues. The floor was not level. We did some investigation and discovered that the floor joist supporting the second story actually had significant dry rot. They no longer bear on the support truss, and the dry rot had kind of taken over the wood that surrounds the lower nails, and literally there are two rusty nails that are holding up this floor joist. If they hadn't been doing what they were doing, this could have resulted in a catastrophic failure with people, desks, file cabinets falling through the floor into the first story. When my engineer did the investigation, he also discovered that the lower quarter of the truss had been significantly compromised by rot and was able to insert a screwdriver most of the way into it before it actually found substantial material. So to handle the situation, we removed the people out of the office, put in temporary shoring, which you see in the lower right-hand corner, and we're executing a repair right now for about $96,000 to fix this particular element.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Go ahead.
On that, go back to that. Where'd the water come from? See, that's one thing that causes dry rot. And this is looks like it's been going on for a long time.
You are absolutely correct. This used to be the ceiling of the cold storage room where they used to store all of the feed that required cold storage before that whole process changed. So the moisture that was accumulating in the cork around the cold storage to insulate it was causing condensation to collect around the members and cause the rot.
So what we did ended up backfiring on us.
Got it. Yep. Okay, so here's a selection of hatcheries. We'll start with Bandon Hatchery. Just some background. It raises Chinook, Coho, Steelhead, and Trout for harvest augmentation. That particular hatchery is funded with license and general fund. There are three full-time employees there. They've identified their number one hatchery maintenance priority being some hatchery housing that's significantly old and needs to be replaced. On top of that, there is a dam that has some issues with leakage and it should be removed. So that particular hatchery is 92 years old. Then Cedar Creek Hatchery raises Chinook, Steelhead, and Trout. Those fish are used for enhancement and harvest augmentation. It's funded through license, general fund, and endorsement. About 3.5 people work there. And their number one maintenance priority is the Three Rivers Trap and Exclusion Barrier down at the collection site where Cedar Creek meets Three Rivers. And that facility is 93 years old. Next is Elk River. They raise Chinook, Steelhead, and Trout for harvest augmentation. It is funded with license and general fund dollars. They have four full-time employees there. And at this hatchery, they need some hatchery technician housing to be replaced. And also the water delivery system piping network needs to be replaced as well.
Help me for a second. Geographically, where is Elk River?
Around Bandon.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. Okay.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, it's on the south Oregon coast, well south of Coos Bay.
Okay. Thank you. And then its age is 49 years. Fall River Hatchery, it raises trout. Those are raised for harvest augmentation. It's funded with license and also Fish and Wildlife Service sport fish recovery dollars. There is one person at that hatchery, and its priorities are an intake fishway, and then also the hatch house needs to be replaced, and that facility is 88 years old. Next is Klamath Hatchery. They raise trout at that hatchery for harvest augmentation. It's funded through license dollars and also sport fish recovery. It has about 4.5 people assigned to it, and it needs a new pond to be reconstructed. And that hatchery is 88 years old. Next is Roaring River Hatchery. It raises steelhead and trout for harvest augmentation. It's funded with license and also sport fish recovery. It's about 5 staff that are assigned there. It also needs a pond to be reconstructed as well, and it is 93 years old. Then next is Rock Creek Hatchery. They raise chinook, coho, steelhead, and trout for harvest augmentation. It's funded with license dollars, general fund, and also Douglas County. There are 5 employees there, and the maintenance priority is obviously that hatchery office repair that I talked about earlier. In addition to that, the intake screen needs some repair as well, and that hatchery is 92 years old. Next is Salmon River Hatchery. They raise chinook there for enhancement and harvest augmentation. It's funded with license and general fund. There's one person assigned there, and its number one maintenance priority is the diversion intake and also fish passage as well. And that structure is 42 years old. Next is Trask Hatchery. It raises chinook, coho, and steelhead for harvest augmentation. It's funded with license and general fund. Almost 4 employees are assigned there, and its priority is a replacement of the hatch house, and it is 101 years old. Next is the Oregon Hatchery Research Center. There are 3 employees assigned there. Its number one maintenance priority is the intake dam bank needs to be stabilized, and this one's kind of a split deal because it actually was the old Fall Creek Hatchery, which they used part of that infrastructure and then built the new OHRC there. So part of it's 68 years old, the other is about 4 years old. So next,
yes. Representative Lewis, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on, you're talking about the age of the hatchery, and then you've got like a number one maintenance priority. Are you saying that the maintenance priority is that old, or the hatchery itself is that old? I mean, what does that relate to, the age on there? Like, I was looking at one of them in here, the building. I think it was like 92 years old, but the building looks a lot newer than 92 years old. So how do you equate the age with the actual maintenance priority?
Sure. So Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Lewis, some of the maintenance encompasses an entire facility campus. So like Director Melcher had mentioned, some buildings are newer than others, and the photos may depict elements that are newer than others to give you a sense of the whole campus. But what was actually targeted is probably older than that. So if you have a specific slide, I can certainly address that.
Well, you've got one right here. You've got a 101-year-old hatch house replacement. Where is that hatch house on that slide there? Do you know?
I do. So in the upper left-hand corner, there's a cluster of buildings. It is the lowest building that's kind of up next to the trees.
Okay.
Yep.
And co-chairs.
Is that the 101-year-old place, or is it just something on that hatchery that's 101 years?
Yeah, and co-chair Frederick and co-chair Witt, members of the committee, I think in many cases the hatch house is one of the original structures. It's fundamental to a hatchery, so we have hatch houses that are very old. I would have to have Ryan dig into the details on the age of this particular hatch house, but I suspect it's probably one of the original structures or very near original structures. When we talk about the age of the facility, that generally goes back to when the facility was first opened.
Yeah.
And there is all of these facilities have individual structures that will be a range of ages because of either additions to the facility or replacements of structures over time. So the age really refers to when the facility was first opened and may well reflect the oldest structures that are on the site, but not the age of all structures on the site.
And not the age of the place it needs to be repaired necessarily.
May or may not be, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yeah, that brings up the point that, you know, maybe 80% of your hatchery has been rebuilt in the last 15, 20 years, but we're still saying it's 101 years old. And I think that you need to slice that out and let people know exactly when they were renovated or when they were remodeled. What I don't want to see us do is what we did in Butte Falls, where we took that hatchery, sunk $6 or $8 million in that hatchery, and then destroyed it, raised it. So I don't want to see us do that. And I think this is a great segue to get involved with talking about, is the hatchery something we want to keep as is, or do we want to change it to a state of the art? Because I think we need to fish or cut bait here. I guess I shouldn't use that. I wish Tom Wolf were here. But I mean, we need to determine what needs to be done comprehensively with a complete layout from ODF&W on what their hatcheries are and the what they want to do, because I don't want to sink a bunch of money in something that's only good for 10, 20 years, 30 years. I really think that's not the way to do this.
Representative Witt, did you have something to add?
No, I was, Mr. Chairman, I was just questioning whether, I think somebody mentioned Tom Wolf, and I didn't know whether he was fishing and cutting bait at a hatchery or not. So. But he's not here to defend himself, Mr. Chairman, so that would be unfair.
You can go ahead and go. Well, thank you very much. Yes,
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess I have similar questions to Representative Escoval, and now is probably the time to ask them, which is, we've got these reviews of overall deferred maintenance needs. We have the DAS one. It looked like you have your own independent one. There's the previous look, and then we have this analysis that's sort of related to one of the policy packages. Has the department been able to look at those reviews and harmonize them in terms of what priorities rise to the top? I guess I'm concerned that we're looking at maybe, I understand that these are high priority needs or you wouldn't be asking for them, but I don't understand where they fall in the overall priorities that may be coming out of these different reviews. And I'm a little bit hesitant to make decisions. If that DAS review is coming soon, I need to know, you know, where this falls, where this type of work falls within the overall priority, and or whether, for the purposes of our committee, these are so urgent that it doesn't, that they fall outside of those other reviews.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Ripson Helm, I think the earlier review that we commissioned, the 2005 review, is largely reflected in our recommendations here. We didn't come up with anything new in terms of what they were recommending that needed to occur at these facilities. So it's in terms of harmonizing between our recommendations and the recommendations from that effort, I think they are really pretty harmonized right now. We did take, with the additional, one of our additional methods of prioritization of this work is, as I mentioned, so critical structures to the operation of the hatchery, but then also when we can get multiple benefits. So you'll see many of these projects also include either fish passage or fish screening, which provides benefits in the basin to native fish stocks. As far as the DAS review, that's, as I said, not out yet, and it is focused only on facilities of a certain structures of a certain size or of a certain value. So it's not going to be as comprehensive as the 2005 review was.
Thank you, Senator Girard.
Yeah, just real quick, and this is as more of a comment. As you know, Kurt, we have individuals that raise trout, especially privately, and the question will always be, are we competitive in the public sector with what we can do privately? And that's always a concern for me, since I do have some private people that raise trout stock.
And Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Senator Girod, the, you know, I think the answer to that question or comment is it depends. And it depends largely on whether it's production that we're adding to an existing facility. So we have fixed costs at a facility that are covered. And when we add additional production to a facility where the fixed costs are already covered, the additional production is very inexpensive. It's truly just, in large part, the cost of the fish feed. If you're comparing it to a facility like you directed us to build a public trout hatchery and produce 400,000 pounds of trout annually, I would be very surprised if we could do that cheaper than the private sector.
Please go on and continue. Thank you.
Okay, so next, ODFW offices and facilities. So this picture is kind of what typically happens when you have a roof.
Yes, just excuse me for just a second. Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And gentlemen, I apologize. I didn't realize we were leaving the hatcheries here. So, but in terms of in terms of our ability to assess the viability of a hatchery, our collectively, is there what kind of metrics do you have? And is it just you're raising fish for put and take? Is there a concern for anadromous species? The rates of return, the rates of mortality, all of those sorts of things. What are the metrics that help to determine the viability?
Sure, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt. The metrics are going to vary depending on the objectives of the facility.
Sure.
So for a facility that is truly a harvest augmentation facility, the metric is going to be how does that fish production contribute to harvest? Two, how does that fish or that hatchery production mesh with the neighboring or adjoining adjacent wild stocks? And so we've been reforming our hatchery programs over 30 years, long before hatchery reform was the buzzword of the day. We eliminated off-station releases in large part 20 years ago. And all that is to minimize strain and make sure that hatchery facilities are, as some would say, good neighbors in the watershed. So for other facilities, so harvest augmentation is very clear. Are they contributing to harvest, and are they not impacting wild stocks? For other facilities where it's not just harvest augmentation, for instance, we have conservation programs for some listed species, the objectives are entirely different. You're not looking at how they contribute to how those facilities contribute to harvest, but you're looking at how those facilities contribute to returning offspring for maintenance of the population.
And so, in your estimation, would there be any of the hatchery facilities that are outside of desired goals?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, certainly love to have the Fish Division staff come here and talk with you at length about our hatchery programs and the reforms that have gone on. But the short answer is no. We don't believe any of these facilities are inconsistent with our policies on.
Thank you.
Okay, so this picture shows some roof damage that we had at one of our facilities. You can see the water had penetrated through the built-up roof membrane and saturated the OSB panel, which then caused the load-carrying member on the pre-engineered metal I-joist to become rotted. We discovered this actually one morning when the acoustical tiles had been so soaked they collapsed onto the floor, and we discovered that we had this ongoing roof leak that needed to be taken care of. So these are the types of things that we face when we work on deferred maintenance for our facility structures. And this particular leak was actually at ODFW headquarters a couple of years ago. So first, Marine Resources Program Office over in Newport. They have 45 full-time employees there. Their number one maintenance priority is actually a complete building replacement and relocation. It has significant issues with the structure itself and also being in the inundation zone and also built on liquefiable soil. That building is 48 years old. Then next is ODFW headquarters. We have 202 employees there. Like I just described, we need a new roof to be placed there. That's our number one maintenance priority. And so the actual structure itself, shell and roof, is over 20 years old, while the improvements that we did are obviously finished in about 2013. So the interior of it's maybe 4 years old, but the exterior is actually a couple of decades. Next is the Willamette Falls Fishway. We have one person that works there. That number one maintenance priority is actually the entrance to lateral leg one in the cul-de-sac next to the Sullivan plant. We have recorded significant movements on lateral leg one entrance block, which needs to be addressed, and that facility is 46 years old.
I'm going to give you a softball question here because I was told the answer to this, but I'm hearing that we're having a lot of problems getting fish through the Willamette Falls Fishway because of sea lions. Is that somewhat correct?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Senator Girod, certainly we have seen the great expansion in the California sea lion population at Willamette Falls over the last, to an extreme level over the last half a dozen years. There's no doubt that the presence of those animals delays fish passage. And in fact, at Willamette Falls, we've had multiple examples documented, you know, with video of sea lions in the fish ladder, which doesn't just slow them down, but will entirely stop passage there. That combined with the hydrologic conditions this year, I think, has really led to a very delayed passage at Willamette Falls. And I did want to mention also on this particular priority, this obviously is not a hatchery facility, so it's not on our list of hatchery facility deferred maintenance items. However, it's obviously a critical pinch point for at least four hatchery programs in the upper Willamette Basin, as well as for our wild fish production, both listed spring chinook and listed wild winter steelhead.
One quick comment.
Yes, go ahead.
Colleagues, I represent most of the districts that he was referring to, the North South San Yam. I represent the top part of the McKenzie, the Clackamas, the Mooloolah. And fish numbers are everything. They just really truly are, because even little cities have mandates compared to what the fish numbers are. So it's extremely important to keep our fish numbers up. And it's very frustrating that we have such a hard time killing sea lions when they're blocking the passage up to those endangered species. So it would be nice if we could get the feds to go along with us.
Thank you. So next, the Klamath Watershed District Office. We have 9 full-time employees there. The number one maintenance priority is an office renovation and a new roof, and that facility is 22 years old. Next is the North Coast Watershed District Office. They have 13 employees there. That also needs a roof and siding to be replaced, and that facility is 42 years old. North Willamette Watershed District Office in Clackamas, 65 or more employees there, and number one maintenance priority is the building and siding and painting all of that siding on 17 buildings on that campus. And they have structures there up to 106 years old. Next is the Rogue Watershed District Office and also the Screen Shop. There are 22 employees stationed there, and they are in need of their conference room to have some renovations, and that structure is 67 years old. Next is the Enterprise Screen Shop and Field Office. There are 20 full-time employees there. They need an electrical upgrade as their maintenance priority, and that structure is 25 years old. Next is the Lakeview Field Office. There are three people there. It doesn't actually have any maintenance priorities right now, and that's mainly because it's only 3 years old. So we kind of threw this one in there just to represent that, you know, we do have facilities that don't actually need some maintenance. They're far and few between, but we do own them. Okay. Next is the Ontario Field Office. There are 6.5 people stationed there. That one actually needs a complete building replacement. I've heard stories that the current location is actually an old onion barn that they've converted into office space and doesn't technically have any offices in it. So they're needing something that actually is an office structure for the employees, and it is 49 years old. And then the Dallas Screen Shop, it houses 18 people. It doesn't actually have any maintenance that's required either. It's 15 years old. This is the type of structure that I'd start expecting maintenance to become an issue. But this one's unique because they actually have $43,000 every biennium to address maintenance. So they're not deferring anything. They actually take care of it as it comes up. And you can tell when you tour the facility, it's in good condition. And it's not needing anything major in the near future. So next section is the wildlife areas. So this is a project that came across my desk. They're needing new siding, as you can see. To some, that's very picturesque and fits well with the background, but that siding has obviously reached the end of its life and needs to be replaced. So those are the types of things that we're kind of seeing in the wildlife area arena. So we have a couple that have been selected to represent today. So Jewel Meadows, its objective is to provide habitat for elk and reduce big game conflicts to the adjacent lands. It's funded with Pittman Robertson and license. There are two people stationed there. And the number one priority is the renovation of a 102-year-old bunkhouse to address electrical, siding, and other issues.
Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could back up one slide, please. Admittedly, that probably needs siding. There's probably few that would doubt that, but I mean, is it being utilized? And so are we money ahead just to demo the thing? Yeah. Or, on what basis would you consider utilizing that? I mean, it calls to question whether, you know, it's penny wise and pound foolish here, possibly. I don't know.
Coach R. Frederick and Coach R. Witt, that's certainly something that we consider as we look at as deferred maintenance gets to the point where you're no longer talking about deferred maintenance, but is it cheaper to just replace the structure? And so Ryan and his crew certainly looks at that as an option. In this case, I believe this is used to store hay for our winter feeding operations. Okay. You know, we don't have staff housed in that building, but it is a structure that is providing a use on the area. So the question is, how do you?
Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious on why one would put old tin, and this is roofing, is what that is, on a side of a building. You should have some OSB with some tieback. I mean, help me out here.
Coach R. Frederick, Coach R. Witt, and Representative Escobar, I may be out of bounds here, so somebody in the back can wave their arms and say I'm entirely wrong, but I think this is a barn that's on a property that we recently acquired, and it was in that state when we acquired it.
And where is it?
I believe that's at White River. Mm-hmm. Yes. White River Wildlife Area, which is east side of Mount Hood.
Follow up.
Yes.
So in other words, we didn't really have a deferred maintenance here. We bought it.
We'll get co-chair Frederick, co-chair Witt. I believe it was in that state when we purchased the property, but we'll verify that for you.
Thank you.
Because I can assure you that I can assure you that Ryan's crew of professional engineers, licensed professional engineers, don't do that. Yeah.
I would hope they wouldn't do that.
Mr. Chairman, it brings new meaning to the term barn raising. So.
Wow.
Okay, so next is Summer Lake. Their objective is protecting and improving waterfowl habitat and providing a public hunting area. It's funded through Pittman Robertson and license dollars. There are 3.5 employees stationed there. Its number one maintenance priority is to upgrade the domestic water supply, and that was constructed in 49 to 50. Next is Savi Island. Its objective is to preserve and enhance wetlands and associate upland habitats in the Columbia River bottomlands. It's funded through Pittman Robertson and License. 7.5 employees are stationed there. Its number one maintenance priority is to provide potable water and a restroom facility at the east side check station, which we have a slide of. So that's the check station, which it currently has no restroom or drinkable water there, and our staff are stationed there regularly to do their job. Next is Ladd Marsh. Its objective is to preserve and restore and enhance wetlands and associated uplands to support wetland-dependent wildlife. It's funded with Pittman Robertson and License. About 2.5 employees are stationed there, and its number one priority is the replacement of storage building that was built in the 70s, and that storage building has confined spaces issues that we need to take care of before employees can really use it safely. And so that concludes kind of the overview of the different deferred maintenance things that we have in our portfolio that we're going to show you today. So this last slide is just to kind of summarize POP 136, our deferred maintenance proposal. Here's a listing of those projects and a very brief summary of what each one's trying to achieve. You'll see a common theme of intake, fishway barrier improvement, intake improvement, and such. And really the heart of it is we have a maintenance need there. Something's broken, and we need to go touch it. But when we do that, we're going to improve the facility through hatchery reform to make sure that we're protecting species that encounter that facility and allow passage to get above whatever the barrier is.
We're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Paul.
So fisheries is a subject area that is well outside my expertise, but I'm doing my best to learn. I'm sort of surprised to learn that we have so many hatcheries that are so old in the state, so that's intriguing to me, and I'll follow up to find out more information. In evaluating which ones you're going to be reinvesting in, what are your criteria for success in those areas? Are you looking at where native species recovery and hatchery fish are coexisting well and prioritizing those, or are you just looking at what's old?
Sure. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Power, great questions. Our first screen, if you will, is we're looking at this deferred maintenance investment only at state-funded hatcheries. So while we have 32 fish hatcheries in the state, only about 10 or 12 of them are state-funded. The others are federally funded. So we're not investing our deferred maintenance policy option package on the federally funded facilities. And generally speaking, the federally funded facilities have been better at addressing deferred maintenance. So first screen was state-funded hatcheries, not federally funded hatcheries. Then the second screen was where we can get the multiple benefit out of the deferred maintenance action, and that would be benefits not only to the critical infrastructure at the facility, i.e. improving a water source or improving water delivery at the facility, but also where the opportunity exists to also improve the hatchery's function in the watershed, so where we could also provide, for instance, fish passage or fish screening improvements at the facility.
Yes, Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I'd like to take a chance to answer a little bit of your question. You asked why so many hatcheries, and it's if you take a fish from one river stream and put it in another that's been reared in another, the rate of return is a lot less. Mm-hmm. So we want to, if we can, have hatcheries on each and every river. Am I kind of out of bounds there?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Senator Gerard, for us, it's about, I talked a little bit about it earlier, our efforts to reform hatcheries, which began literally almost 3 decades ago, to eliminate the off-site releases and focus hatchery releases at the facilities in the watershed, because you get the best return to the facility and minimize the strain and competition in in wild fish spawning areas. So Senator Girod is correct in that by having the facilities release the fish directly, we lower their impact on native fish populations. We don't have the intent to have a hatchery on every stream, though.
It might have been a bit of an
May I ask?
Yes.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that I'm understanding it correctly. So native species recovery, endangered, threatened, is a totally distinct measurement of success from the hatchery reinvestment, and you're simply looking at hatchery fish and making these decisions to reinvest.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Representative Power, we are including in the assessment the benefit to the native fish populations in that hatchery basin. So, for instance, some of these facilities will include fish passage. Now, the historic approach by the Old Game Commission and the Fish Commission over the last 100-plus years was that when they built a hatchery, they also built a barrier to prevent, by design, to prevent any fish from getting above that facility, which leads to some disease issues. And over the last several decades, we have dramatically changed that policy, because our facilities were limiting access for wild fish into, in many cases, exceptionally good spawning habitat. So one of our objectives is to provide passage at those hatchery dams so that we are fully utilizing the basin for wild production. And so a number of these here include fish passage at hatchery dams. Yeah.
Yes. Chair Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt, you were mentioning earlier that, and if I get this wrong, correct me, but I think you were stating that if the interests were purely poundage of fish produced, that the private sector may be able to outcompete what we're able to do as a state. If that's correct, why is it that the federal government has chosen then to contract with the state of Oregon for fish production?
Sure. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt. My example that I gave earlier was specific to trout production.
Okay. All right.
And it was really starting from scratch. If you told us, build a new hatchery, raise a certain amount of trout, and or go down the private sector pathway, I would be very surprised if we could do it cheaper, because we build a new facility, we prevailing wage comes in, we've got represented workforce that we would hire to run that facility. There's a whole layer of administrative functions that go along with being a government entity that raise our costs, and so I'd be very surprised if the private sector could not do it cheaper than we can do it. When it comes to trout. When it comes to salmon, though, there are the Oregon legislature has adopted some very rigorous statutes on privately run salmon hatcheries in the state of Oregon. And I think when the example you're referring to is the Corps of Engineers had indicated they were going to go down this private contracting pathway for our salmon hatcheries in the Willamette Basin, and they've currently reversed that and said, no, we're going to go with a sole source contract with the state of Oregon to run these hatcheries like we've done for the last 50-plus years. I think they ultimately came to that conclusion when they looked at the statutory requirements for a privately run salmon hatchery, and they concluded that there probably wasn't any private vendors that could clear that bar, so to speak.
Follow up?
Yes, go ahead.
And so, is the viability of these hatcheries then dependent upon federal government contracts? I guess more to the point, would we as the state operate those hatcheries were it not for federal government contracts?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, I want to make sure I understand what you mean by those hatcheries.
The federally funded hatcheries.
Co-Chair Frederick and Co-Chair Witt, there are examples where the federal government runs their own hatcheries. Mm-hmm. So there are federally run hatcheries, and the Corps of Engineers could contract with another federal entity to run those facilities. I will say I know that we can run our hatcheries cheaper than the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
For a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
There are examples where the federal agencies or government will contract with tribes to run hatcheries. So when we talk about these federal hatcheries are not the hatcheries we're talking about when we talk about deferred maintenance. Our deferred maintenance investments
Correct.
Are directed at our state
Correct.
Funded hatcheries.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So follow up again, please. So I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to phrase the question here. Does the federal government does the money that the revenue that we receive from the federal government pay in total the cost of operation, maintenance, et cetera, administration of those hatcheries that are federally funded?
Co-Chair Frederick and Co-Chair Witt, basically yes, but there are some nuances. So let me just walk you through it.
Okay.
When we get a contract from the Corps of Engineers to operate, say, Willamette Hatchery, to produce a certain poundage of spring Chinook, they contract with us to produce those fish. They cover the full cost of production. We also charge the approved federal overhead rate, mm-hmm. which covers administration. So it does cover the backside of the agency, if you will, as opposed to just covering the boots on the ground that are raising the fish. In many cases, and for many of those facilities, the state owns part of those facilities, too. So they're not entirely 100% federally owned. The state might own some of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, we own some of the real property as well as the infrastructure. In other cases, we just own the infrastructure. So we have then, if there is additional capacity available at that facility above and beyond whatever it is we're contracted to produce, we will many times use state funds to rear additional production at those facilities. So when you look at like a lot of our generally federally funded facilities in the Willamette Valley, they're largely Corps of Engineers funded, but they all have a small state component, and that's because we're using available capacity at the facility with state dollars to raise additional fish above and beyond the Corps' mitigation obligation.
So if we were to look at this on the basis of profit and loss, is it a paying venture for the state of Oregon then to be operating these facilities for the federal government?
Co-Chair Frederick and Co-Chair Witt, I'm sure there will be many different opinions on that, but our opinion is definitely a profit.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Do we need to have Kathy come up next?
Nope.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and appreciate that. And I guess tomorrow we have two things to deal with, as I recall. Two work sessions. I'm going to close this particular public hearing on 5010, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And tomorrow we'll see you at 1 o'clock as we have two work sessions to deal with a couple of bills.
What are we dealing with tomorrow?
State lands.
And DSL. And
what was the other one?
Is it
Marine Board.
Is it their budget?
I believe so, yes. So, this should be fun. So, let me... Yes.
Mr. Chair, how do we get a budget note? Because there's a couple of things in this budget coming up here that I'd like to get a budget note on, if possible. Have us decide whether we want to or not.
Can we set up something so that talk about? Okay. I mean, I've already closed the hearing on the public hearing, so if we want to go ahead.
You'll
talk with. Okay, we'll have a conversation there. That's good. So we'll see you tomorrow afternoon, 1 o'clock, and I'll close this hearing, the Subcommittee on Natural Resources hearing for May 3rd, 2017. There we go.
So a couple of
17. There we go.
So a couple of
3rd, 2017.